When he was 51, he started having the memory symptoms, and he made a wrong turn, and he ended up 3 hours away on the other coast of Florida. He saw a neuropsychiatrist, and he mentioned dementia, and that was really frightening.
Alzheimer's campaigner and author, Dr. Mary Newport.
He said, I think it might be Alzheimer's, and he was put on Alzheimer's drugs, which really didn't seem to do anything. Dr. Alzheimer, in 1906, he found these plaques and then tangles. So for many years, they thought this is the cause of Alzheimer's disease. The thing about Alzheimer's disease is that the brain develops insulin resistance, and this is the same problem that happens in type 2 diabetes. On a typical diet, like the American diet is well known to be high in carbohydrate and lower in fat. On that kind of diet, you almost never are producing ketones. But you can take MCT oil, and it doesn't matter what you eat, you will make some ketones. He started improving. There were changes every day in the beginning. And he told me on the day that he started the coconut oil, he felt like a light switch came on in his head. There are 35 million people with dementia in the world, and I can't keep this a secret. If he improved, other people will improve. Here's where the twist in the story is.
Hey there, friends. Welcome once again to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. You'll find me here every Monday and Thursday talking health, well-being, and self-improvement with many, many people of interest, experts in their field. So if that is your thing, well, then show your support for the channel. Like, subscribe, share, and leave a comment if you're on YouTube. Become a subscriber over there too, and leave the podcast a positive rating. We're almost 5 out of 5 now on iTunes and on Spotify. Incidentally, on Spotify, you can watch the videos of these episodes too. Now, 24 million people worldwide are living with Alzheimer's disease. And as people live longer, this number is only going to grow. In this episode, we speak with author Dr. Mary Newport, whose own husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 54. She defines for us what the illness is and what the symptoms are. We hear how Dr. Newport's own research led her to giving her husband coconut oil mixed with MCT, or medium chain triglyceride oil, which had a dramatic effect on her husband's condition. Discover why Alzheimer's is referred to as type 3 diabetes as we explore the relationship between glucose, insulin, and the brain. We hear of the merits of a ketogenic diet, the work of the renowned Dr. Richard Veitch, and the power of ketone esters to help improve brain function in patients showing cognitive decline. We also hear of the link between herpes simplex virus and Alzheimer's disease. This is a fascinating discussion and a personal account of Dr. Newport's husband and her relationship with the disease affecting so many people today, the disease that is Alzheimer's disease.
Alzheimer's is something that we're hearing more and more of these days as people live longer and longer. It's touching an awful lot of families out there, and it touched your family. You have a very personal story going all the way back about 2 decades at this stage, to when your dear husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 54. Could you bring us back to that period of time? Because the diagnosis came after he had been experiencing symptoms for a period of time. So could you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So my husband was an accountant, and I'm a physician. I did newborn intensive care for 30 years, was hospital-based. So he worked from home. He worked on a computer all day, and he took care of our kids. He was there for them. And so that was really great. But when he was 51, he started having symptoms, basically memory symptoms. He would, forget appointments, even if I called him 30 minutes ahead of time, for the girls. And he would then, it kind of evolved to the point where he'd forget if he'd been to the bank and the post office in a given day. And he would misplace the mail when he did bring it home from the post office. And so it was getting to be a problem. And he was also quite depressed at the time, and he saw a neuropsychiatrist, and the neuropsychiatrist said, I think depression is the likely reason for his memory problems, he mentioned dementia, and that was really frightening. As you can imagine, he was only 51 at that point. So he was on an antidepressant, but he continued to get worse and worse, and we moved about an hour away. I had a chance to open another newborn intensive care unit, and he was confused. It was a small town, and he couldn't remember how to get around. He would lose his way. he would spend hours in the garage looking for something. He'd forget what it even was. I'd come home from the hospital. He'd still be looking. He couldn't remember what he was looking for. You know, really strange behavior. So this is in 2004 when he was 54 years old. And he saw a neurologist at that point and had the complete evaluation. And he said, well, he has dementia. He has some type of dementia. He said, I think it might be Alzheimer's, you know, the doctor. And he said, let's give it another 6 months, see if it progresses. And it did. In that time, he developed tremors and his memory worsened. And like he did poor on the testing when he came back. And then he was put on Alzheimer's drugs, which really didn't seem to do anything at the time. You know, we didn't notice any differences. So, you know, he just kept progressing. When he was 56, he could no longer even turn on a computer, much less do any accounting on it. He had to stop driving. He actually got lost. He was following our daughter home from repairing her vehicle, and he made a wrong turn, and he ended up 3 hours away on the other coast of Florida. It was frightening. It was frightening. And luckily, he still remembered how to use a cell phone at that point. So he had to quit driving, and everything just deteriorated, you know. In 2007, he had stopped kind of making meals for himself if I was at work, you know, and people sometimes don't understand. They think you have a diagnosis of dementia and this happens overnight. Suddenly you can't remember anything, but it's really a very, very gradual process in many cases. So he, you know, had continued to progress. And in 2008, I really thought I was going to lose him within 2 or 3 years. So he had a chance to be in two new clinical trials. There were two drugs. There hadn't been any for quite a while, but two new drugs became available, and they removed plaques from the brain. One was an intravenous drug, and the other was an oral medication. And so we wanted to try out for both of them.
The plaques in the brain, those are characteristic of Alzheimer's. It's a buildup of protein deposits in the brain. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's a protein called beta amyloid. But the crazy thing about that is, you know, for years and years, Dr. Alzheimer in 1906, he first described these. He had a younger patient with dementia. She was 53 years old. And when she passed away, he looked at her brain and he found these plaques and then tangles in it's basically like the extensions of the neuron. The tubules that are in them become tangled. They become tangled up, and it's, you know, causes the cell to die, you know, when that happens. You know, so those were described about 120 years ago almost. And so for many years, they thought this is the cause of Alzheimer's disease. These plaques and tangles are the cause, but they've never been able to figure out what causes that to happen. So now they're doing, they can do amyloid PET scans. They can look for this in the brain with a PET scan. And they see that many people who are well into their 80s or 90s, they have lots and lots of plaques and even some tangles, and yet they are functioning perfectly normally. They don't have dementia.
So there's no cognitive decline in these people. If we go back then to 2008 then, so your husband, there was the potential for him to go for one of two trials, but I don't believe he was a suitable candidate for either.
Well, yeah, what happened? He actually did get accepted into a trial. So he was scheduled for these two different drugs 2 days in a row. And the night before the first screening, I got on the internet and I started looking for the risks and benefits of these two drugs, because I thought if he gets accepted to both, then we get to choose. You can't be in two trials at the same time. So I happened on a press release that was mentioned in the same article as one of these drugs. And it was about a medical food that was going to come out in about a year. They had done what are called phase two trials. And the first was a pilot study, you know, where the people came twice. And on one day they got a placebo, and another day they got MCT oil, medium chain triglyceride oil. And then they were tested about 90 minutes after they got the oil. And almost half the people with Alzheimer's who, when they got the oil, they improved. Which was quite interesting. It was like 9 out of 20 people. Well, then they did another longer trial, you know, where they had 152 people, And about half of them were on a placebo and the other half taking this MCT oil. And it was one dose a day. And again, almost half of them improved and they maintained the improvement, you know, for almost 6 months. Some people stayed in study for 6 months and they seemed to maintain the improvement as long as they kept taking this. So I was familiar with MCT oil because I'm a neonatologist, a newborn intensive care specialist. And we used to add it to the feedings of our tiniest preemies, MCT oil, and it would help them grow faster and they get home faster. And they started putting it in infant formulas. This was in the 1980s. And that's because they were trying to mimic the fats that are in human breast milk. Human breast milk has medium chain triglycerides in it, MCTs. So I had gotten their patent application when I read this press release. It didn't say what it was or how it worked. So what I learned is that when you consume medium chain triglycerides, MCT or MCT oil, that it is partly converted to ketones. And ketones are tiny molecules. They're smaller than glucose molecules. And every cell needs some type of fuel to work, to do whatever functions it has. And usually, like on a typical diet, like the American diet is well known to be high in carbohydrate and lower in fat. On that kind of diet, you almost never are producing ketones. But you can take MCT oil, and it doesn't matter what you eat, you will make some ketones. So this was really a brilliant idea to get fuel into the brain. And the reason that that's important in Alzheimer's disease is because there are areas of the brain that have decreased glucose uptake. Glucose doesn't get well into the brain or into the neurons, the really important cells, you know, that allow us to do everything, you know, our memories and movement and all of that, you know. So ketones are taken up normally by these same areas of the brain. And that was not shown until 2016. So a few years later, they were able to demonstrate this with the ketone PET scan that, in fact, yes, ketones are taken up normally in the Alzheimer brain. So it can provide a fuel. So this was a valid hypothesis, you know, so to speak, that was basically proven out.
Because normally the brain will use glucose as a fuel. And
right.
So then in that context, then, can you just, before we go back in time to whenever the trial was taking place, could you explain to me for me then how Alzheimer's then is referred to as type 3 diabetes then by drawing in that glucose into this conversation?
Right, right. The thing about Alzheimer's disease is that the brain develops insulin resistance. And this is the same problem that happens in type 2 diabetes. Blood sugar's constantly elevated and your insulin levels are higher. They're high all the time. You know, you need insulin to basically put glucose into cells. For those who don't know, insulin levels get higher and higher and higher. The cells aren't responding anymore and they're not allowing glucose in spite of high amounts of insulin being available. So in Alzheimer's disease in the brain, there is a problem like that. There could be plenty of glucose surrounding the cells, but it's not getting into these specific areas of the brain because the cells are not responding to insulin. And it used to be thought that insulin doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, that it's not in the brain, but that's not true. It just crosses at lower levels relatively low levels compared to what you see in the blood. And there's also some research showing that insulin is made in the brain. And they also, the same group that first started calling it type 3 diabetes, they have done research showing that there's also a deficiency in making insulin within the brain. So it's insulin resistance, insulin deficiency in the brain are big components of why glucose doesn't get in. There's some other things too, enzyme deficiencies that get glucose into the mitochondria, you know, that make the energy. And another is glucose 1 and 3 transporters. So when glucose like presents itself to the cell, insulin kind of unlocks the door, so to speak, either directly or indirectly. And these glucose transporters carry glucose into the cell from the outside to the inside of the cell. And those are deficient in Alzheimer's disease. So there's several different reasons why glucose just isn't getting in. And it's really a strange, you know, combination of things that make that happen, you know, but ketones don't need glucose transporters. They don't need insulin. They freely cross into the brain and they're taken up eagerly, just like instantaneously. If you have ketones available, most areas of the brain will prefer, that will take up ketones in preference to glucose.
So you must be really excited then when you're looking at this literature and reading all of this information about potential study that's going to take place involving MCT and the production of ketones and this other fuel source in order to get into the brain, bypassing the whole issue with type 3 diabetes or the glucose uptake into the brain, etc. So this is, you're thinking, oh my God, this is great for my husband. Yeah. So tell us then, what is your next move then as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, well, I learned in the patent application that MCT oil was extracted from coconut oil. I had not known that before, even though we used it in the hospital. I didn't know if I could get it. You know, we'd used it in a hospital setting, so I wasn't sure if it was available. It turns out it was, but I didn't know that at the time. So I'm reading this, all about this information in the patent application around 1 a.m. in the morning. And his appointment is at 9 a.m. 0900, and about an hour away, you know, so I didn't have any chance to do anything about it. So we actually had a day before and a day after he started coconut oil studies done for these clinical trials. So we go for the study. He had to take a test called a mini mental status exam. It's 30 points. And if you're normal, you'll score 29 or 30 points. You know, most people don't even lose 1 point on this test. It's fairly simple. He scored only 14 points, and he needed 16 to get into the study. So we were really devastated, and the doctor asked him to draw a clock, and I can show it to you.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Oh, I see it there. So, well, it doesn't really resemble a clock. It's like something, to be honest, that a child would do, obviously. So his motor function was obviously affected by his Alzheimer's.
It looks like a 3-year-old drawing.
Exactly.
Circles, a few numbers. And the doctor told me, she said he's on the verge of severe Alzheimer's. And I really kind of knew that. But to see that drawing was really alarming. So on the way home, I thought, let's pick up some coconut oil. So we went to a health food store. I had been told as a doctor when I was in training that coconut oil is an artery clogging fat. And I thought, why is it in a health food store? But I knew it was there. So we got it. Turns out that's not true. But when we got home, I got on the internet and I was able to find the fatty acid composition of coconut oil on the USDA website here in the U.S., and it turned out it was 60% medium-chain triglycerides. So I calculated a dose to try to equal what was given in the medical foods. They were giving 20 grams or 20 mLs of MCT oil, and that worked out to about 35 grams or 35 mLs, a little over 2 tablespoons of coconut oil. The next day, he was scheduled in the afternoon this time, like at 1 in the afternoon, 1300. And I gave him for breakfast in oatmeal a little over 2 tablespoons, this amount of coconut oil that I had calculated. And then we proceeded to the trial, you know, the testing for the clinical trial. And this time we were in a different city, a different day of the week, different floor of the institution. And it was still spring. And those were the 4 things he had gotten wrong the day before. Well, this time he got them correct. He answered them correctly, despite almost everything being different, except the season. And he gained 4 points. He got 18 out of 30. He needed 16 to qualify, so he qualified for the study. And we were elated. And, I didn't know. I thought, okay, was it really this, or did we just get very lucky, or what? But we're going to keep it going. You know, basically, I just became obsessed with learning everything I could about ketones, MCT oil, coconut oil, got recipes. One of the things in the application, the patent application, was they said that the level of ketones from MCT oil peaked at about 90 minutes on the average person, and that the ketone levels were basically gone back down to baseline by 3 hours. And I thought, wait a minute, the brain needs fuel 24/7, 24 hours a day. And this only covers 3 hours, you know, so why not give him more, give him some with each meal? to try to keep his ketone level elevated. And so that's what we did. I got recipes, a cookbook, you know, right away. I think I stopped at another health food store and got a cookbook that day. And, you know, just started the next day, like every morning, I would give him the 35 grams of coconut oil and then started cooking with it at every meal. And coconut milk is loaded with, it's mostly coconut oil. So I would give him that. And we had coconut everything, coconut flakes, coconut this, coconut that in our house, just to try to keep his ketone levels up. And he started improving. There were changes every day in the beginning. And he told me on the day that he started the coconut oil, he felt like a light switch came on in his head, in his brain, that he could think better again. He could put his thoughts together. He was having trouble even finishing a sentence. He couldn't remember what he was saying. And now he could finish sentences. He started some people call it a dead look on their face. They just have very little expression. He became very expressive. He was smiling. He was joking again, you know, making jokes. He loved to whistle. He would whistle these medleys of songs. He started doing that again. And he had some other physical symptoms. He would walk very slowly, and his feet were like stiff. You know, he had a stiff gait, almost, you know, well, like people with Parkinson's have that. And he had tremors. His hand would tremor when he was trying to eat. His jaw would tremor when he was speaking. When he was trying to finish a sentence, his jaw would start to tremor. And those went away. The jaw tremor completely went away. We never saw it again. His hand tremor, he would have it sometimes in the morning, but after 20 or 30 minutes after having the coconut oil, that would go away, and we wouldn't see it again, you know, until sometimes the next morning, you know. So those things happen really quickly during those first few days.
Now, it's important, it's just to interrupt you there. It's important to say that while he has been accepted onto the other clinical trial, it actually turns out in the end that he was placed on the placebo. So your determination is that any improvements in his condition came about as a result of your supplementation of coconut oil.
Right. Yeah. About 2 months after he tried out for the other trial again, and got accepted. His score was even higher. It was 20 out of 30, 2 months later. And so he actually entered the trial 2 months later with an oral medication, and he was on placebo for 18 months, we know now. So all of the improvement that happened during that time, the only difference was that we had added coconut oil originally, and then at about 6 to 8 weeks, I started adding MCT oil as well. And kind of what spurred that on was Dr. Richard Beach. He is an MD. He passed away in 2020. He's my hero. He was 84, but he was still working at the NIH, and he had been working on this idea of ketones as a therapeutic since the 1990s. And he had been developing a ketone ester that could get ketone levels much, much higher than coconut or MCT oil. So I found him in Wikipedia, and his phone number was there, and I called it, and he answered. It was shocking. And this was maybe a week after we started the coconut oil. Steve had improved so much. We felt like our life had changed. And, you know, it just like other people need to know about this. But I wanted to talk to an expert. So I spoke with him. He told me about his ester. He told me that the people who had the idea about the MCT oil had talked to him about 5 years earlier. And he told him, no, the ketone levels would not be high enough to help anybody. But he was fascinated that this had help my husband. And so at 2 weeks, my husband drew another clock, and I'm going to show that.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see.
Now, this time, to people listening in, it actually resembles a clock, whereas the previous time it resented a 3-year-old scribble. So I believe then you sent a photograph of this new drawing to Dr. Veach, and he was very impressed by the improvement in your husband's condition.
Yeah, I sent him the first one and the second one together, and he was shocked. He called me and he said, "Well, this is unexpected," was the word that he said. And we had quite a conversation, and he started sending me hypothesis papers that he had written in 2001, between 2001 and 2004, about potential therapeutic of, you know, this ketone ester that he had been developing. And I mean, it was for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, Huntington's, chorea, even congestive heart failure and autism. I mean, he proposed it for many different conditions, which all have in common, they have a problem with insulin resistance in the brain. And even diabetes, you know, it could benefit people who have type 2 diabetes. They and even type 1 diabetes, they have trouble getting glucose into their cells. And this is in every organ.
I mean, so just to explain again, the ketone esters then give rise to about 10 times the amount of ketones that you would normally get from the MCT oil or the coconut oil.
Yeah. And it depends on how much you take. But at the dose that he was proposing, it would make it 10 times higher levels. But still well below, like, you know, a constant question is, won't this make somebody have diabetic ketoacidosis? You know, people worry about that when they have diabetes. They have to watch to make sure their ketone levels don't get too high. But the levels for that are much, much higher than what you would get even with a ketone ester. And it only happens in somebody that has no insulin available and their blood glucose is very high. So this is when ketoacidosis can happen, diabetic ketoacidosis. And if you gave somebody who was at that point, theoretically, it could push their ketone level up. But that is so rare, you know, that somebody would actually be in ketoacidosis and then take a ketone ester. It's just kind of unlikely, except that the interesting thing about the ketone ester is it makes the blood sugar go down when you take it.
The blood sugar, okay. And so did Dr. Veach then take your husband's case under his wing as such?
Yeah, not so much as a practicing physician, but he definitely, you know, we were communicating constantly. And his ester was at the time about to undergo toxicity testing. It had to go through toxicity testing before the FDA would recognize it as safe. So that was the goal at that point. So my husband couldn't take it right away. So in the meantime, you know, Dr. Veach said, well, why don't you try to get his ketone levels higher and give him MCT oil? Because ketone levels, he measured Steve's levels. We had his blood drawn before and for several hours after taking coconut oil for two doses in a day. And the levels were low-ish. You know, they were not very high, but they were definitely there. After the evening dose, the levels went quite a bit higher and were still rising to like 0.35. I mean, it wasn't like phenomenal, you know, but the levels were still rising at that point after when we stopped checking them at 3 hours. So basically, they were drawn at a local lab and were sent like freeze-dried, so to speak, you know, with, liquid nitrogen to the NIH, and they ran the levels the next day. And then Dr. Veach said, well, let's do the same thing with MCT oil. And so a couple of weeks later, he took 20 grams of MCT, just as in that medical food study, and his levels did go higher. It went up to about 0.4 or 0.5 at about 90 minutes. And the levels were gone at 3 hours, just like in the pilot study that they had done with the medical food. So, but Dr. Veach said, okay, the levels are higher. He said, why don't you forget the coconut oil and just give them MCT oil? And I thought, wait a minute, there might be something else in coconut oil that is facilitating this, you know? So why don't we mix it? And so that's what I started doing. I started making a mixture of MCT and coconut oil. And MCT oil, a lot of people have, to put it politely, diarrhea that can be explosive if they start taking too much too quickly. So we had to advance it fairly slowly, you know, but I kept the coconut oil going and then just started adding little bits at first of MCT oil. At this point, he was getting it for every meal. And then the mixture that I made was like four parts MCT to three parts coconut oil. And then I was still cooking with coconut oil. It's easier to cook with. And we would put it on certain things like straight coconut oil. And he just continued to improve. At 2 months, he could tie his shoes again. He hadn't been able to tie his shoes for over a year and a half at that point. His gait, the way he walked, was completely normal. The stiffness had completely gone away. He could pick his feet up and run again. And then at about 3.5 to 4 months, at this point, he was probably getting 9 or 10 tablespoons a day of a combination of MCT and coconut oil. So quite a lot. We were spreading it out through the day. Basically announced to me, he brought a book and he said, I can read again. And I'm like, he hadn't been able to read for about 1.5 years. And I said, well, why couldn't you read? And he said, it's like, he said, you know, when you have like satellite brick up on your TV, he said, it goes into pixels, he called it. And he said, the words would do that. They would break up and go into pixels on the page. And he couldn't read. And that had stopped. He could read again. And then a couple months after that, he could comprehend what he was reading, you know, because he would have trouble, you know, he'd have to keep rereading things to understand. But then he could read and retain the information. And around 9 or 10 months, he could tell me what he had read earlier in the day and remember details. It was one that my favorite example is he was reading a Scientific American magazine article about Albert Einstein. And he told me about it several hours later. It was incredible, you know, and this was a man who couldn't read at all. He couldn't finish a sentence. His mood had lifted. He was happy again. He felt like he had a future again. It was just really incredible. And this was just coconut and MCT oil at that point.
So aside from the combination then of the MCT oil and the coconut oil, have you changed anything else in his diet at the time? Are there any other dietary alterations, increase this, get rid of that? And because I know ultimately the diet resembled a ketogenic diet. So could you explain to me exactly what you eliminated and what you included?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, 2 years before we started the coconut oil, we had switched over from what I call the convenience food, fast food diet to a Mediterranean style diet. And we had this, so this was 2 years before the coconut oil. And it was because I had found a study showing that people who had Alzheimer's who ate the most Mediterranean-like diet lived on average 4 years longer than the people who ate the least Mediterranean-like diet. And I thought, wow, nutrition has something to do with Alzheimer's, you know? So I read everything I could about the Mediterranean diet, and we started doing that, you know, and got rid of all the junky foods that we were eating, and really a healthy whole food diet, whole grains, olive oil and butter we were using instead of the regular vegetable oils that were had trans fats in them, we now know. He, you know, he kept declining though, in spite of that. And I had enormous health benefits from it. And he was healthy in every other way, you know, but his brain kept deteriorating in spite of that. So that was already in place when we started the coconut oil. And he, the other thing too, right before we started it, during the months leading up to that, he was constantly eating fruit. He craved fruit, and I could not keep enough fruit in our house. He would stand at the kitchen sink in the evening and just eat fruit, 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 fruit. And I think his brain was craving glucose. It just couldn't get in. So that was one of the early things that changed almost right away, is that he quit craving all that fruit after we started the coconut oil. And as we were increasing it, he was starting to put on a few pounds, and we realized, no, we have to substitute it for something in his diet. He was a slim, I mean, he was just a normal weight guy, you know, he really didn't want to gain any weight. So we basically started substituting it for other oils and fats that were in the diet. We had already kind of started doing that. But then he just started eliminating the carbohydrates. And he kind of did this naturally. He was leaving the bread behind. If he had a sandwich, he would just the meat and cheese off the sandwich. He would leave the rice. He wasn't eating much, if any, pasta. And so we just kind of stopped putting that into his meals. And at this point, he was getting a pretty sizable amount of the coconut and MCT oil. And there weren't co-monitors to test this yet, you know, but I'm quite sure he was on a, you know, pretty good ketogenic diet at that point.
So his health and his condition, as far as the symptoms of Alzheimer's are concerned, has continued to improve from the point of your intervention with the MCT and the coconut oil. And so this is a revelation to you. You've contacted Dr. Veach, And you've also made attempts to spread the word further, but you get resistance from other people in the medical field because this is deemed to be a little bit too innovative at the time.
Too simple to be true. And so when this happened with Steve, probably about 2 weeks into this, I'm like, oh my gosh, there are 35 million people with dementia in the world, and I can't keep this a secret. If he improved, other people will improve. Why should they have to wait for a medical food? You know, because the MCT oil was on the shelf too. Even the C8, this was a C8, which is one of the medium chain triglycerides. For those who don't know, they're C6, 8, 10, and 12 are considered medium chain triglycerides. So this medical food was C8, and this MCT oil was available over the counter, and it was sold mostly to bodybuilders. When they would use MCT oil, it would help them increase their lean body mass, you know, which was quite interesting. And in some countries, they were using it for weight loss, because when you take MCTs, it's converted to ketones, but the rest of it is used immediately as fuel. It's not stored as fat. So if you substitute it for other fats in the diet, you know, potentially it can help you maintain your weight or possibly even lose weight. You know, so we already had uses like that. People with fat malabsorption problems, you know, could take MCT and, do better, you know, with that kind of thing. And it was in infant formulas. It was coconut oil and MCT oils were added to infant formulas starting in the 1980s. And they still are. If you look on the label, almost every commercial infant formula will have coconut oil or palm kernel oil, which also has a lot of medium chain triglycerides in it. And some also have MCT oil, like for premature newborns, for babies that have digestive problems. So, it's just been widely available since the 1970s, and especially in the 1980s when they started putting it in these infant formulas. So, and it's been in drinks, you know, even some of the drinks that were out for seniors had a little bit of MCT oil in it, the shakes that seniors sometimes take to supplement their nutrition. So, it was out there, and I thought, why should anybody have to wait for a medical food to be pronounced safe, you know, recognized as such as a medical food, when you can buy it? It's on the shelf. You can, you know, do coconut oil. There are several different kinds of MCT oil that people could already buy, including the C8. So I started writing. My sister suggested, she was a Supreme Court Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, whose husband had Alzheimer's, and she was in an Alzheimer's study group that was connected with the Alzheimer's Association here in the U.S. And I wrote a really long letter. When I look at it, I think, oh my gosh, no wonder, I don't know if she didn't read it. It was very long. But the point was, you know, there was this medical food. I explained the basis of it, the scientific basis, and that this medical food was still not going to be out for a while, but it was on the shelf. And my husband's only one person, but all these other people in their studies had improved, and other people would improve. So why don't you get your medical people on this? get these clinical trials done, you know, get this out, you know, so that people can know about it. This is just a food. It's just something you can eat that could help, you know, people with Alzheimer's and all these other neurodegenerative conditions possibly improve. And, you know, so I waited and nothing. I heard nothing. I wrote to the Alzheimer's Association, nothing. I wrote to politicians. We had a big election that year. So I was writing to them. I was writing to all the major news stations. You know, I wasn't hearing back from anybody. It was very frustrating. And then I had an opportunity about 2 months after Steve started the coconut oil. The Alzheimer's Association had a big, they always every year have an international conference. So this time it was in Chicago in the U.S., and I basically contacted them. They have an exhibit hall, and they have all these different drugs mainly that they're exhibiting, huge exhibits. And the company that had the medical food was going to have an exhibit there. And I thought, why don't I write up a case report, a little case study of my husband, and I could get a table in the exhibit hall and I could pass it out, you know, to the there were going to be 5,000 researchers there. I thought this is a great opportunity to inspire them to somebody maybe interested in studying this, you know, and getting this out, and they're from all over the world. So this could happen all over the world all at once. So I contacted them and they agreed to let me have a table. I sent them the article that I wrote. They said, okay. And I paid for it. We made arrangements to go. I had 1,500 copies of the article printed up to distribute there. And then 3 days before the conference, I was contacted by them and they said, we changed our mind. We're not going to allow you to have a table in our exhibit hall. And I went back and forth with them and I could not convince them to let me have a table. And they said, you can come to the conference, but you cannot distribute your report. Anyway, it can't even hand, you know, they didn't want me to even hand it to anybody, you know, there, you know. Well, we had all the arrangements, we had all the articles printed. So I decided to go to the conference and Steve came and my sister and her husband came to help us. You know, they were going to be in the booth originally while I was attended the conference and they be with Steve. And so we went and we thought maybe we can distribute it outside the convention center. But the convention center was so huge that most people were dropped off inside the convention center. So there was no one to hand to outside. So it was very frustrating. And I did bring copies in with me. And I went to see all the poster well, as many as I could, poster presentations. There were something like 2,500 poster presentations over 5 days there. And I looked for researchers that had anything to do with nutrition, with insulin and glucose. You know, some people were studying, you know, this idea of diabetes of the brain. They were talking about intranasal insulin, inhaling insulin and things like that. But nobody had anything about ketones. But I would speak to them and then I would hand them a copy of my article to try to get them interested. So I passed out probably about 200 copies of it to the researchers there. And we distributed health food stores in Chicago. And when I got home, Steve and I went around to all of the health food stores in our area and we gave them copies of it. And then I started getting invitations to speak at the health food stores locally. And yeah, which was so Steve would come and he would answer questions. People were amazed because he could tell people what it was like to have Alzheimer's. And he answered questions about, you know, his vision, you know, what had happened with the reading and how he had improved. And he talked very clearly. And it was just, you know, much of the time, I mean, I could, as his wife living with him, I could still see problems, you know, but he, you know, to people that we were meeting socially, they did not know or realize that he had Alzheimer's, you know, that he had this going on. So it was really quite amazing. And then I got invited to be on a local radio show to talk about it. And then that spurred an article in a regional newspaper. And the reporter who took the information for the story that wrote the article, she did a beautiful job. She interviewed Dr. Veach as well and some other ketone researchers at that point and some other people that had improved. That I was already hearing back from other people that had improved because my article got out on the internet, you know, the article about that was in the regional newspaper, and it had a photo of Steve and I with his three clocks. I didn't show you the third clock was even better, you know, than the second clock. It was not as messy. And so we had three clocks with our photo and it was on our paper and it went everywhere all over the world. And then I started, I had also been sending out copies of my article and I had my contact information on it. I put it on there, you know, taking a chance. I thought if the right person finds this, they need to know how to contact me. So I started getting phone calls and emails and, you know, it was really quite amazing. And all of this happened, you know, really towards the end of 2008, you know, in May of 2008 is when he started the coconut oil and into 2009. And then I put up a website and, you know, I really started hearing from quite a lot of people at that point who had tried it and had improved.
And so all this is happening organically and you're hearing from other people who have also taken this approach and they've improved as well. So that is super encouraging. You're also seeing the improvement in your husband's condition all throughout. And then, so from the point of view then of officialdom, quote unquote, does the medical field get interested then in your approach then at all, other than Dr. Veach?
Yeah. So there were doctors who became interested in it. And I had gone to Chicago to look for a researcher, but it turned out there was one very close by me here in Florida. I'm in near Tampa, Florida, and University of South Florida is there. And their PhD, Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, had recently come, finished his postdoc, and he was a new official PhD, and he had come to University of South Florida. And he was already studying the ketogenic diet, but they were using it. He was basically working through grants from the Department of the Navy in the U.S. And the Navy SEALs, when they dive, they wear these rebreather masks. They don't want bubbles to come up so that they're detected, but they're breathing 100% oxygen. And if they're down for 10 or 15 minutes, they can have a seizure, a serious seizure. They could potentially die. You know, so his task was to try to find some kind of treatment that might prevent that from happening. And the ketogenic diet was an obvious idea, you know, obvious possible treatment for this, preventive treatment. It had been around ketogenic diet for 100 years to treat epilepsy. In 1921, it was discovered that a very high fat, very low carbohydrate diet could help stop seizures in people with epilepsy. And up to that time, they had used fasting as a treatment. They would sometimes fast somebody for 7 to 10 days, sometimes longer, to control their seizures. And when they introduced this very high fat diet, it also helped control seizures. So it's been around, you know, to treat drug resistant epilepsy for over 100 years. So Dominic was, D'Agostino was using this diet, studying it in animals. He had all these little hyperbaric chambers. He still does in his lab. I've gotten to visit there quite a few times. But we met up in early 2009. He had seen the article about Steve and I, and then he recognized us when we came to the University of South Florida for a research update about Alzheimer's. And he introduced himself and invited me to come to his lab. And he became interested not just in the Navy SEALs, but everything ketones. And he just started studying it for everything, for Alzheimer's, for ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, rare metabolic disorders that respond to ketones, GLUT1 deficiency syndrome, just a number of things like that. And he's become really one of the he's not even a rising star. He is a star in the field of ketone research at this point. This was around 2008, 2009, 2009 when we met, and he had not known that a ketone ester was even available. So he became, someone who just was actively also testing Dr. Veach's ester and other ketone esters, as well as the coconut and MCT oil. He developed ketone salts in his lab and tested them in his lab. And there are many companies now, there was one big company, well, two, right away, who started selling ketone salts in 2016. I think they've been available in the UK probably since about 2018 or 2019. But the ketone ester also came on the market in 2018. And Dominic was very instrumental in pushing all of that to actually get out to the people, that people could actually use it. And Dr. Veach didn't get FDA approval for recognition as safe, for his ketone ester. So that it looked available.
Could I ask you, Dr. Newport, you mentioned there that the ketone ester became available in 2018. Now, I know, sadly, your husband passed away in 2016. Was it a bittersweet thing that the ketone ester became officially available 2 years after your husband passed?
Well, here's where the twist in the story is.
And, I like twists.
Yeah. Oh, okay, in 2010, 2 years after he started the coconut oil, he became the first person with Alzheimer's to get to take it as part of a pilot study. Yeah, so basically what happened, he was in the clinical trial on placebo for 18 months. Well, he actually switched over. So this was around December of, I would say the first of the year, January 1st of 2010, he switched over to the drug. We found out later, and we suspected it because his hair started growing out like a white like gold color, you know, his hair. He just started growing out. And that was a common symptom of that drug. You know, the researchers knew it. So they always had an idea of who was on it and who wasn't on it. And he was only on it for 6 weeks, but he had a big setback during that time. He had been doing so well, and he had some new symptoms of Alzheimer's. He started looking in the mirror, and he didn't recognize himself. You know, one day he says, that's you, but from in the neck down, this is me, but from the neck up, it's not me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what is this? You know, and he kind of declined in his ability to take care of himself. I had to start talking him through taking a shower step by step. And he had been able to take a shower, you know, before he started getting that drug. And then he had things like wounds that wouldn't heal. He like had an abrasion on his leg that wouldn't heal for a month. And if he would nick himself when he was shaving, he would bleed for 3 or 4 days, and then he fainted. And so I thought, you know, and then the researchers, being a doctor, they kind of told me, they said, you know, the people that were pretty sure on it, they've declined a lot over this last year. And so I decided to pull him out of the study, remove him from the study. So he got it for about 6 weeks. And then Dr. Beach said, well, you know, the ester passed toxicity testing. So why don't we do a pilot study? One person, you're a doctor, you'll recognize a problem if he's having it. That's what convinced him that I was the one to, you know, be able to do this, you know, with my husband. And then he just started sending it. His chemist was making it drop by drop in the lab every day. And he would send me a large container of it. And it was the raw material. It tasted absolutely horrible. It tasted like jet fuel. Some people call it jet fuel or furniture polish, just what it tastes like. I mean, it tasted horrible. And I had to figure out how to make it drinkable, you know, that Steve could drink it. And oh my gosh, it was quite a challenge. I tried a whole bunch of different flavors, and like orange and grape worked pretty well. and diluting it with water, it helped. But he shuddered every time, but he knew what it was. The thing about Steve was he always knew that he had Alzheimer's, and he knew what he'd been able to do, what he couldn't do, which was depressing. But he also knew about the ketone ester. We had talked about it constantly, and he just couldn't wait to take it. And so he took it willingly. He understood what it was. It wasn't that we were, you know, tricking, you know, a person with Alzheimer's into taking it. He knew exactly what it was. And even the first day, he improved. The very first dose that he took, 2 hours later, he wrote out the whole alphabet. He hadn't been able to write at all, you know, for probably a couple months at this. Well, it was April, so he had started that other medication in January. So it was several months that he hadn't been able to write and was having these other problems. It took him 20 minutes to do it. He tried over and over and over. But just that he kept trying was amazing for somebody with Alzheimer's. But he sang the alphabet, and then he wrote it all out, which was really profound. He was extremely pleased. He cursed his first grade teacher for his poor penmanship by name. He remembered her name. And then the next morning, he took a shower, picked out his clothes, came out fully dressed. He did all of that completely on his own without me even knowing he was doing this, or having to guide him through step by step, you know, taking a shower. You know, it was pretty amazing. So we saw improvements right away. And then over the next 6 weeks, all of the other new problems that he had kind of gradually went away. It was really profound. And he was stable for another 20 months after that. And Dr. Beach kept sending us the ester. And it kind of fluctuated. He would, at the end of their fiscal year, he would start getting short on it. And he couldn't send us as much. So Steve couldn't get as much of the ester as what Dr. Beach felt he needed. And, you know, so I would start spacing it out, you know, giving him fewer doses. And, you know, we would see a little bit of deterioration during that time. But as soon as he could get the full dose again, he would kind of come back. And what happened was in 2013, Steve had, so this was 3 years after he started the ketone ester. I had a caregiver with him when I would go to the hospital. I was still doing newborn intensive care, you know, at this point. And I had hugged him, kissed him. He told me he loved me, hugged me. And 5 minutes later, I mean, I lived very, very close, and I got to the hospital, and the lady taking care of him called me and she said, he's having a seizure. He's having a terrible seizure. He fell, he was standing, he fell back and hit his head and he stopped breathing and he was blue. And she had called emergency services and I rushed home and he was still blue. I got there before they did. And he was barely breathing and she was stimulating him to breathe, you know, but it was really bad. And they took him to the hospital. I found out later he had another seizure on the way to the hospital. And his brain was already so fragile. They did a CAT scan and they didn't see any sign of a stroke or, you know, any bleeding in his brain, you know, so it wasn't something like that that happened. Something triggered the seizure, and it's common in Alzheimer's disease in the late stages to have seizures. And this was in spite of getting the ketone ester about an hour before that. So that kind of baffled me for a while. It didn't cause the seizure, but it didn't stop it. And, so he spent several days in the hospital. I really thought he might die at that point because he was completely, he was unconscious at first, you know, or maybe 12 or 24 hours. He didn't come around. But then he did. And then he got up and was able to walk. He, you know, got up out of bed and walked. But he was completely dependent after that. I think the head injury and the lack of oxygen for too long, you know, we didn't have oxygen in our house at that point. We did after that, but not before that. And, you know, he ended up living for another 2.5 years after that happened, which was really kind of profound. We kept the ketone ester going. We kept the coconut and MCT oil going as well. And his body was perfect from the neck down. When he passed away, he was a good weight. He had always, you know, he had to be hand-fed, but I had wonderful caregivers, and they would spend an hour with him, you know, to make sure he got enough to eat. And physically, he was in great shape, but unfortunately, Alzheimer's eventually took him. You know, he just became unresponsive and one day and quit eating and drinking. And that's a common way for people with Alzheimer's to pass away.
Now, since that sad day in 2016, I just want to get a sense and give people a sense of how things have progressed in this field since then. Yeah. Because that's 8 years ago now. So has there been much progress as far as this, what many people would consider probably an alternative approach in that it's just, it's purely, it's wholesome, it's natural, and it's organic.
Yeah. Yeah. By this time, the message was really getting out pretty well. And there were a number of researchers and physicians who were taking this approach with their patients. I would see them, especially since then. There's University of South Florida started a metabolic health summit that they hold every 2 years, roughly. And it was called a different name in the beginning, but there were researchers from all over the world that were coming to learn about basically ketogenic therapies and other metabolic therapies for Alzheimer's, but they had expanded it. For example, Dr. Tom Seyfried, he was already looking at a ketogenic diet as an adjunct to treatment for cancer. And this was already in 2007, 2008 that he was looking at this.
I spoke with him yesterday.
Right. And his story is so interesting. He's a geneticist, but he said, gene mutations aren't the cause of cancer. It's a mitochondrial problem. It's also a problem with processing glucose normally in mitochondria. And if you can starve, most cancers don't use ketones as fuel. They ferment glucose. It's not a very efficient process, but they eagerly take up glucose. So if you can starve the tumor by using a ketogenic diet, you can provide the other cells with ketones and you'll deprive the cancer cells of glucose. You know, the glucose levels usually get quite low when you're on a super strict ketogenic diet. And he has shown, and now there are a number of other cancers, you know, people studying this that have shown that the cancers often do shrink and sometimes can be controlled. Sometimes they can be removed more efficiently. Surgically, they can be removed. They respond better to radiation if somebody's on a ketogenic diet. And there's also some studies of the ketone ester that are in progress, you know, for different cancers as well. So, you know, this whole idea, that's a huge movement. And then, you know, Parkinson's disease, yeah, many people with Parkinson's respond to ketogenic therapies. And
do you think then that people, not just the medical world, but lay people are now more receptive to that metabolic therapeutic approach?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, another huge area that just opened up fairly recently is metabolic psychiatry. So there are people, there's a group, the Bakzuki Institute, or group, I should say. The Bakzukis are very wealthy people, and their son had a terrible problem with bipolar disorder and other, you know, he was living on the street sometimes despite their wealth, and he was on so many drugs to try to control his symptoms, you know, that he was just, he couldn't function, he couldn't work, he, you know, had all kinds of strange ideas about life and all of this. I heard him speak on a stage recently, and his Dr. Christopher Palmer, he connected with, who had other patients that had improved with a ketogenic diet, even people with schizophrenia. He had a lady in her 70s who had had it for 50 years that had improved and was able to function much better in her life, you know, with a ketogenic diet. People with like these disorders, they have areas of the brain that don't take up glucose normally. You know, they're metabolically not functioning normally. And in these cases, you know, ketogenic diet helped. In his case, it was phenomenal what it did for him. I mean, he is just totally fluent. He's completely with it. He's got a great job. He's, you know, functioning again. And you know, so there are several other psychiatrists too. Gloria Ede, EDE, is another one who has been using this in her practice, and other psychiatrists that I've heard speak about this. And they're helping people with bipolar disorder, migraines respond to it, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, you know, all of these psychiatric conditions are responding to ketogenic diet.
Extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
If we can just go back briefly then to Alzheimer's once again, just in relation to the origins of Alzheimer's, I heard you speak before about the link between the herpes simplex virus and Alzheimer's. Could you talk to us about that connection?
Yeah. So my husband had, the reason that I started looking into this is that he had constant fever blisters on his mouth. You know, he would, every maybe 2 or 3 weeks, he'd break out. He'd have this big fever blister, but last for 10 days or so. And this was kind of constant most of his adult life. But when he was 29, he had an infection with these fever blisters around his eye, and he was sick. He was nauseous. He couldn't sit up. He was very sick when he had it. There's a condition called herpes encephalitis. And I think looking back that he may have had a mild case of herpes encephalitis where it infects the brain. This is a problem in newborns too. So I had babies that had herpes simplex in their brain that ended up with severe brain damage. And what I had been taught was that the eye is the portal to the brain. It is part of the brain, the eye. And when you have an infection in or around the eye, it can spread into the brain that way. And so Steve had this infection, and he was 29 at that point, you know, when that happened. And he told me he never felt quite the same after that. And so there have been, there's a lady, she's in England, her name's Ruth Itzhaki, and she had been studying the herpes simplex virus and Alzheimer's since the mid-1990s. So for many years, she had been studying this, she and her group, and other people were studying it as well. And other people were studying other, you know, microorganisms, candida, chlamydia. There's a spirochete that causes Lyme disease. The spirochete, syphilis, is well known to cause dementia if it's not treated. And the symptoms look very similar to Alzheimer's for these conditions when people have them. So I contacted her, and she had already published a number of papers about this. And they had, you know, for example, infected mice with herpes simplex virus, and the plaques and tangles turn up in their brain very quickly, you know, after they were infected with this virus. So you know, she's quite sure that this is one of the causes of Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, many people struggle. I mean, they have fever blisters and, you know, the virus lives in the nerves to the mouth, but this nerve originates in the brain very close to where the center, the amygdala, which where memories are formed and where learning occurs, that, you know, the nerve originates there, you know, so potentially if there's an outbreak on the mouth, there could also be an outbreak in the brain, you know, going on. That was basically her thinking. And there's a medication called valacyclovir that is an antiviral that is effective, and it kind of can control herpes simplex virus to some extent. It keeps it from multiplying. It doesn't outright kill it. And so, you know, there's been a lot of that kind of study, you know, for all these different microorganisms and hundreds of studies that have been going on, but it's just been completely ignored. The Alzheimer's Association, I didn't go to their conference for a few years, but I have for probably about 10 years. So I've gone to their conference and during the pandemic, watched it virtually. They have had one session, full session on infection and Alzheimer's disease in all that time, like a 2-hour session. I happened to be there for that and got to meet Ruth and Saki and some of the others that were working on this. And, you know, one of the things too is that there's a group in the U.S., Dr. Rudy Tanzi and his group. There was a Rob Moir, M-O-I-R, who unfortunately he was the big proponent of this idea, but he passed away in 2019, unfortunately. But they have found that the beta amyloid that forms the plaques is antimicrobial. It kills viruses and bacteria and fungus. And when they analyze these plaques that are in the brain, they see, for example, the DNA of herpes simplex virus in the plaques. Ruth Ditsaki, you know, in human brains, you know, they found this when they did autopsies. 90% of these plaques had herpes simplex virus DNA in them, in the people that she studied. And some normal people had them too, just not many, not as much, you know, of that in these plaques. So, you know, the interesting thing that ties it to what I was doing with my husband is that coconut oil, of all things, has a fat called lauric acid. Half of the fat in coconut oil is lauric acid. It's considered one of the medium chain triglycerides. It has some properties of medium chains and some of long chains. It's 12 carbons long. You know, we're C8, C10, C12. So this is C12. And lauric acid is highly antimicrobial. It kills herpes simplex virus, chlamydia, fungus, many different kinds of bacteria, dental pathogens. Those have been attributed to, you know, as possible. Possible cavities in the mouth have been connected to Alzheimer's. So lauric acid kills all of those. And somehow it supports normal, healthy bacteria in your gut. It's really an amazing substance. And you know, in Asia, where they process, you know, most of the big coconut oil factories are, I've gotten to visit these now, you know, they can extract, separate all the fatty acids in coconut oil. And lauric acid for decades and decades has been used in industrial applications, veterinary applications, medical applications as a disinfectant, as an antimicrobial substance. You know, they combine it with a molecule, a sulfate molecule. So they have sodium lauryl sulfate, and you'll see this in soaps and detergents and antiviral wipes and sprays, lauric acid, you know, but you can eat it as coconut oil.
And it's extraordinary. Your knowledge on this is encyclopedic. It really is. I only wish that the medical world, those institutions of officialdom, were as open-minded and as lateral thinking as you've been as far as embracing innovation is concerned in this area. Our time is running short. Just what I want to do is I want to point people in your direction, because I know you've written multiple books, including clearly Keto, which is your most recent release from 2022. Yeah. If people want to seek you out online, where can they go?
Yeah, I have a website. It's coconutketones.com, C-O-C-O-N-U-T-K-E-T-O-N-E-S ketonewsletter.com. There's no Y in ketones. Some people try to put a Y and then they can't find me. If they look up my name, they'll probably find my website, Mary Newport. And my books are there. I have, you know, I've been working on this website since 2008. So there's a tremendous amount of information on there. Maybe too much. Some people find it overwhelming. But I have a page specifically for Alzheimer's and dementia. And it kind of goes step by step through coconut oil, MCT oil, and the ketone esters, ketone salts. It explains all of that. Links to my books. I have a third edition of my first book just came out in September too. Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? The Story of Ketones. So I got to finish my husband's story, talk all about the ketone ester, all the more recent advances. And this one is about a Mediterranean ketogenic diet and about many other things beyond diet that people can do to try to prevent, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's. So a lot of information. Yeah.
A lot of information indeed, a lot of knowledge there. And I have to say, you're a force of nature, no doubt. Your husband was very proud of you, and you're continuing his legacy and the work that you're doing. What I will do, Dr. Newport, is I'll pop a link to all of those things in the show notes of this episode, so as people then can head your direction. But for the moment, can I thank you for sharing your and your husband's story with me today?
Oh, you're welcome.